Hello, I'm Penina from Circle Care Services, and welcome to My BCBA Life. Circle Care Services is an ABA therapy agency, and we're all about giving BCBAs the support and community you're looking for. With this podcast, you're not on your own anymore. You're part of a BCBA community committed to making this world a better place to BCBA. Once this episode is complete, you'll be able to obtain a free CEU certificate for the clinical topic discussed. You'll need to confirm your attendance by taking note of the three surprise words I will drop throughout this episode. There is a link in the show notes below of a form that will ask you for your information and the surprise words that we need to generate your CEU certificate. Thank you, and let's get started. Welcome, Trisha, to My BCBA Life for the second time, actually, and I think well, last time we spoke, we really had so much more to say. I'm saying you had so much more to say, and it was a lot. So we said, we'll meet another time, and here it is. And it's actually a topic that is very, I never heard of it from another BCBA, so I'm excited to bring this to the table. But before we even get to the topic, just for those who didn't hear you before, tell us who you are, and then we'll hit the topic.
Yeah. So my name is Trisha Lund. I've been a BCBA for about 10 years. I started off in schools and then I went to a clinic. And then now I work primarily with teens and adults that are living in group homes and day habs. And I do that in Texas.
Okay. So I think what this topic came up for you because you are working with the older population, and it's a scary topic when we talk about it at first, and you break it up very well. So the topic is about death and how people with disabilities respond to loss. So just take us into why this became a topic that interests you, and more about the topic.
So I work mostly with adults, and I kind of got to the point where a lot of my adult clients, their caregivers were dying, and this was causing just a huge disruption for them. And I noticed that, first of all, no one had really worked with them prior to the death, right? We didn't really talk about what death was or, kind of help them process, hey, this is something that could happen in the future. It was just, bam, like a thing that happened. And then oftentimes they weren't being given support after the death happened. And I think sometimes it was well-intentioned. I think sometimes people don't know what to do, and so they don't do anything, but that can lead to just more like grief complications in this process. So that's kind of what made me think, hey, I need to go and research this more. And in the ABA literature, like you said, it's a relatively new field. So it wasn't until like the 1970s, 1980s that a researcher in the UK said, hey guys, guess what? People with disabilities actually experience grief. Because before then, it was the general idea, hey, people with disabilities don't grieve because they can't understand death. So in general, this is a new area. And then in ABA, it's also new. I don't see, and that's why I had to go get additional certification in thanatology, because I wasn't finding what I needed.
Wow. So with your certification, what is that?
Thanatology. So T-H-A-N-A. Yeah.
Okay. That's new to me. Tell me more. What is that?
Yeah. Okay, it's amazing, and I have learned so much, and I love it. So, okay. Thanatology is the study of death and dying, and grief and loss. And so, I mean, you can look at that with the whole range. I mean, people in my coursework are studying hospice, or we have people who work in funerals, or I think right now I'm the only BCBA that has gone and taken this additional certification, but it's fascinating.
What does it take to, like, what is it? It's, like, psychology courses,
So there's a couple of routes you can take. So you can go get a second master's. What you can also get is a certification. So the certification is going to be less courses, but you do have to pass an exam through ADECT, which is the Association of Deaf Education and Counseling. And then that certification is going to kind of show, hey, this person has done this coursework. They're certified to practice still within their scope, right? Like, I can't go out and be a counselor because I'm not a counselor, but I can take principles of death and loss and grieving and apply that to what I'm doing right now.
Wow. It sounds fascinating. And
obviously a big need. I'm saying, unfortunately, loss isn't unique to older population either. There's sickness, there's horrible things. And we all, I'm saying, I think a lot of people know or heard of children who suffered a loss. And, you know, a loss could even be, it doesn't have to be a caregiver. Think about it, grandparents, you know, that are, those are big people in children's lives, or even like a close pet that a child has and got lost. Or I'm saying there's so many ways to interpret loss. So I guess take us through this a little bit of grieving and loss with children who have disabilities. What is different, or how do we approach them differently than we would a typical person who's dealing with grieving or loss? My first surprise word is door.
Yeah, so two things that come to mind. So when I first started studying this, I was trying to figure out, hey, how do people with disabilities grieve differently than the neurotypical population? And that I kind of had to get away from that because in general, there's no one way of grieving. Right? There's no universal way of grieving. And when I've talked with parents, I've said, I wish I could tell you, hey, expect this and this and this, but it's individual, right? The way you're going to grieve is different from the way I grieve. So you aren't necessarily, you know, I can't say all autistic people grieve this way because that's not really a thing. But I think the biggest thing to realize is their cognitive level and how that is going to impact their ability to understand what's going on and their grief responses. So For kiddos, they don't tip. So in the neurotypical population, kids don't really understand the abstract concept of death until around the age of 8. And that's because there's some basic principles that they have to understand before they really get it. So for instance, they have to know that death is permanent. When grandpa dies, that's a permanent thing. He's not just going to pop up again, right? Which is what we see in video games, right? Right. Like in general, our culture is not teaching this correctly. Yeah.
Reality.
And then universality. So that means that everything is going to die. And that's a harder one, right? And I, in some CEUs I'm doing, I talk about there's a continuum, right? So there's this continuum of knowing like all plants will die, all animals will die, all this will die. And then moving on to my family will die. That's a thing that's going to happen, right? My friends will die and I will eventually die. It's universal, right? Yeah. We all die.
We're not, right.
And then also understanding that it's really only living things that are going to die, because death means that there's a biological reason when someone dies. The heart stops working, the lungs stop working, there's something in the body that stops working. It's not just, you know, again, I'm going back to video games, right? It's not just like, bam, you lost a life, you're now gone. Like there's right. a biological reason for it. And then understanding the biology piece and then causation. So understanding that there's a cause, right? Even if they know, hey, it's because the body's not working anymore. Well, what caused the body not to work? Was it a car crash that, you know, caused the lungs to puncture? Or was it someone that had a heart disease that caused something to not work? So there's a causation. It's not, someone just doesn't fall down dead randomly. So when we look at our neurodivergent population or people with cognitive differences, we have to take that into account. You know, what aspects of death are they understanding? And then that's going to, I think, kind of guide how much they're going to get it and how long their grief responses are going to be or whether or not they grieve. So for instance, you might have a kiddo, you know, like if you have a little 5-year-old in your clinic, right? And grandpa dies and you might not see any reaction. And that could be because they don't understand that concept of death. They don't really understand yet, oh, hey, grandpa's not coming back. And then it's really common to not see grief responses until a couple years later when, bam, my brain has matured. I kind of get it now. And now I really understand that loss.
Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting because, you know, it's when we talk about this grieving thing, and I'm like, do we even know? Like, thank God I didn't ever suffer such a serious loss, but I'm wondering if I would know how to deal with it, because even for a typical person and even an adult who's for the most part healthy, to deal with anything that's such a big loss is a lot. So just to realize that, and we could be dealing with just emotions, but we understand what happened. So say we go into denial and all that, but we know what happens. I think like it's for these people to understand what you're saying is that the basics, just like the foundation of what's happening, forget about what you're feeling, forget about what, how your life will change now, forget about that. Just the basics to understand that they're very confused. And I think that's like a huge part of it, to realize, like you said, like find out where they are, find out, you know, what they understand or don't understand. And then you could take it from there. You know, it's also, you're saying how if a 5-year-old kiddo in the clinic lost the grandfather and you wouldn't see it, like, oh, you know, they look totally fine because they don't even know what's happening. I was listening something recently of someone who lost their father at a very young age, and she was totally fine. You know, she didn't process it. She didn't believe it. He's going to come back, all that. And then she was living by her grandmother, who was heartbroken and couldn't understand why her grandkids didn't care that their father died. And then they lost a pet, and they were heartbroken and shrieking and so, so upset. And the grandmother was like, what is wrong with you? You lost your father and you're okay, and you lost the pet. And she said, like, looking back, that was my way of grieving for my father. Like, it was easier for her to grieve for her pet for whatever reason, but that was really her grieving for her father. So, like, I wish my grandmother understood that. So it's just like, it's really complicating. And, you know, all those points, it's like, of course he's not coming back. Of course, you know, it happens to everyone, but it's not, of course. So it's like,
well, and you bring up an interesting point too. You know, the amount of grief reactions that we have, or how long our grief is going to last, it depends on a lot of factors. And I talk about this in a CEU I made about how to do functional behavior assessments that are grief informed. So you're going to look at the relationship, right? Like, what are the dynamics of the relationship? Sometimes, and I see this a lot with my adult clients, sometimes relationships with family are pretty fraught. Right? Like, yes, I had good times with family and that's great, but maybe there was abuse, maybe there was trauma, maybe there was neglect. And so grieving responses are going to be a little bit more complicated because there's a lot of feelings in there, right? But sometimes with a pet, right? Like, pets give you unconditional love.
Right.
And there's a concept, this was created by, his name is Kenneth Doka, and he was an amazing researcher, and he coined the term disenfranchised grief. And essentially that is grief that's not acknowledged by humanity. And you see that with some losses, like with the death of a pet. Oftentimes society is like, girl, that was just a pet. Why are you crying over that? Yeah. And they tend to minimize it, which makes it even harder.
Wow.
And then people with disabilities, they experience that all the time because, like I said, we still have this assumption that they can't grieve. We don't take them to funerals. We don't involve them in memorials. And there's a tendency in society for people to think their grief is invalid because they have a disability.
Do people, you know, really think that?
Yeah. And I mean, I think in maybe more professional settings, like we're kind of, you know, moving past that. But I do think that this is where BCBAs can do a lot when it comes to like parent training and parent education. And I think, especially when it comes to the funeral part, you know, what I hear from parents is, well, I don't want to upset them, right? I don't want to upset them. I don't want to cause these behaviors, which I get, right? Like, I mean, especially if you're grieving yourself, the last thing you want to do is like co-regulate with another person. Yeah. And so I think that's where like BCBAs can really come in and do some good, is provide some education about why that's necessary. Because there's research that shows that involvement in death rituals, funerals, memorials, wakes, that's all very Eurocentric. Like, obviously you want to be very, you know, culturally aware,
right.
But that can help. It can help in the grief process. And so I think, you know, that's a small thing, right, that BCBAs can do. We know how to modify the environment. We know how to provide accommodations. We know how to front load. We can do that.
Right. My second surprise word is frame. So what would you, for let's say a child who, you know, everything in the child's home is relatively normal, everyone's healthy, when do you think it's a good time, or is that not a good time, to start talking about death with a young child?
Oh, girl, do it now. Yes. Like everyone, we need to start having the conversations right now. And that doesn't mean we're jumping into, guess what? Mom is gonna die someday. 'Cause I mean, that's also not like best practice, you know? But and again, I go back to this continuum, right? Like understanding neutral deaths, like the death of a plant, or these flowers that mom got for Mother's Day are now dead, or hey, I saw a dead bug on the side of the road, or you know, this wild animal died and I see the roadkill. Do that first and start using death-related vocabulary, because what I've seen too, and this is especially true for people with AAC devices or communication devices, we're not programming death-related vocabulary into their devices. So they will never be able to talk about it. They're silenced, you know? So we need to start teaching some of that death-related vocabulary, and we can do this in like natural ways. Go outside, find something that's living, find something that's dead, talk about the difference. Well, what's the difference between this flower and that flower? Well, do you think the flower, this dead flower, is it going to come alive again? Oh, it's not. Well, why do you think that is? Or you know, use video games and TV shows, right? Like Disney, like Snow White, right? Oh, hey, well, Snow White's dead, and the prince just came and kissed her, and she woke up, huh? Do you think that's something that can happen in real life? You know, so it's just, you can have those conversations in a really natural way. And really, our goal here is to start being more comfortable with death before there's this really big personal loss. Because if we can start talking about it and not being so death avoidant, it's going to make it easier when ultimately a death loss will occur, right? Because a death loss is going to occur for everyone.
Okay. So, that's a you know, everyone hears the word death and they go running, and I think that's probably part of the issue. But the way you just had that conversation, like about plants, about wild animals, whatever it is, it didn't sound so scary. And I think that's the point, to be able to like understand the concept in a very neutral way, where it's not, you know, it's not gut-wrenching or anything. And then when something happens, depending when it, not if, when something happens, it's okay. Like, it's not as scary. I understand it more. So say something does happen. How do you then approach the child? Like, what do you do?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first things I would want to do is because a death loss is going to naturally decrease this sense of safety that the clients have. And so whether or not you're the BCBA, you're the RBT, you're the family member, I would start with that. Like, are they feeling safe? How do I know that they're not feeling safe? What can I do to create an environment where this client is going to feel safe again? And so really focus on that first. And this is where sometimes you might have to put some of those skill acquisition goals on hold for a little bit, right? Because especially after a death loss, the brain is really struggling, right? It's struggling to make sense of what just happened. And so it's also natural to see decline in skills. So let's take a second. Let's get this client stable. Let's make sure they're feeling safe. Let's look at their grief reactions. What behaviors are they happening are happening? And make sure that we're kind of prioritizing that. That would be my first thing. And I want to say this, but I'm having a hard time figuring out like an ABA way to say this. But this, I guess this is just my personal belief. Can we just sit? Can we sit with the feelings? And again, that's going to depend on the client and their ability to sit with hard feelings. But I've seen that sometimes the biggest thing that you can do is sit with someone in their discomfort. And so they know, hey, I've got a person here with me, even in this really ugly, messy situation. So I know it sounds woo-woo, but that's what I would say is like some of the biggest things.
Yeah, well, you know, that's part, I would think that's part of making a person feel safe. Like, I feel like it goes hand in hand. And a little kid, they're not able to necessarily feel it like they should, but even like they could, you know, they're, and I think that's what you maybe have said, that a child, to me, a different time even, is that a person with a disability, an adult age, might be feeling the grief of like a child, right, who doesn't have those, the ways to like really sit with their grief. Like, they don't even know what to do. But like, I know there's art therapy where kids could just draw and you see, you know, and just like sitting with them where they're at. It doesn't have to be how I would feel it. It's how they feel it. So do they feel it while playing a game? That might be, I'm assuming. Like, I'm curious how, like, when you say, like, sit with their feeling, sometimes it's not just sitting with the feeling. I'm sure it can manifest in other ways. I'm curious, like, from your experience, if you've seen something that's not usual and you can't imagine sitting with a feeling like that, doing that, but others could.
Right. Yeah, well, so, I mean, you bring up a good point, and we see this especially in children, that it is really natural. I mean, children are so good at reading their bodies, and they know when their body has had enough. And so they're naturally going to oscillate between these really big feelings, right? And then, oh, hey, I'm going to go play, right? I'm going to go to this safe space. I'm going to go to where I feel okay. And then we might oscillate back and forth. So I guess when I say sit with, I'm go where the child goes. We're playing Barbies now? Cool. Let's do it. We're crying now? Wonderful. I'm here with you. We're going to go draw love. You know, so kind of being with them regardless of what the feelings are. And I think also being aware of grief reactions. So a grief reaction or grief response is a behavior that someone has because of a loss or a death loss. I mean, some natural things we think of might be crying, right? Like someone that I love dies and the grief response is going to be, I cry, right? And obviously you're going to have like a variety of them. But what I have seen, especially with some of my group home staff, and it goes back to training, right? I'm not trying to shame anyone. This is also a piece where I need to do more training with them. They punish a grief response. So my client is crying and they're throwing stuff in their room and they get their phone taken away. Essentially, they just lost their phone because they're upset that someone died. To me, that's not compassionate. And so we need to rethink the interventions that we're doing when someone is going through that death mm-hmm. loss. I don't think that's the time to be using extinction and punitive measures.
Right. No, for sure. I'm saying, like, going back to what you said, the first thing is to make sure that they feel safe. So mm-hmm. part of that is, obviously, as long as they're not harming themselves, is whatever response they have, it's right. not going to be long term. It's a response to grief. Grief settles down after a while. So just to be with them where they're at means, I guess, being them with them where they're at, no matter what they do, even for an adult, if it does get to aggression in a safe place, not aggression where anyone's being harmed, obviously, but, you know, just like shaking, like being there with them and letting them just do what they need to do. My third surprise word is paper.
Yeah, because feelings also have to be felt. And I think we talked about this when we did some of the somatic stuff. If we dump these feelings down, and this also correlates with acceptance and commitment training, if we try to ignore the feelings, they're not going to go away. So let's make some room for them, you know? And going back to what you had said about like simple things that people can start doing now. So there's you have primary losses, right? So that's the actual death that happened. My mom died, my sister died, my roommate died. And then you have secondary losses. And those are all the losses that are coming because of the death. So for instance, I had a client and their dad died. So that's the primary loss. The secondary loss was he now had to move into a group home because dad was dead. He couldn't take care of him. No other family member felt like they could take him in. He used to be in a band. He played the guitar in a band. And he couldn't be in the band anymore because no one was available to take him to practice. He used to have more financial freedom, but that financial freedom has kind of decreased because of the person that's now in charge of his money. His dad used to take him to holiday events. Well, now he can't go see his extended family because dad is gone. And so it's those, and especially for people with disabilities, it's those secondary losses that are going to be sometimes a lot bigger than the primary loss. And as BCBAs, this is where we can come in and help identify all those secondary losses and find ways to like mitigate that, right? Like, can we find someone else to take him to band? Is there a staff member that can take him to band practice? Is there an extended family member that can pick him up for holidays? Can we find ways to give him more freedom with his money? And that, I think, what I love about this concept is that's a really easy thing for BCBAs to do. You know, we're not entering into a space of counseling. We're not entering into spaces that are outside our scope. We know how to make an environment more reinforcing. We know how to make an environment more safe. And that is an easy way to help people who are going through grief after a death loss.
It's like a very important point that like we all kind of know, but like you said it so clearly, primary loss, secondary losses, and it's true sometimes secondary losses, I think maybe because there's so many and it affects the actual day-to-day, yes, it could feel like more. And you brought up like subtly, but I think it is important to address that, yes, like to stay in scope in how BCBAs intervene. So could you help, where is the boundary when it comes to me knowing this, thanks to you, and then, okay, I'm going to do my own research now, so I know even more, but then I'm put into the situation, and what belongs to me and what belongs to another specialist?
Yeah, so I actually have a CEU coming out on that, so I collaborated with an LPC about that, so like that will be coming up soon. But there's a really cool, I'm gonna pull it up, there's this article that I love. It's called Exploring a Continuum of Support for Bereaved Individuals with Disabilities. And this was published back in 2007 in the Journal of Intellectual Disabilities, because like I said, it's been hard for me to find stuff in the ABA literature. I've had to go, you know, outside to find stuff. Anyway, so this, these two authors, Reed and Elliot, they came up with this really cool continuum. So I want you to picture like a triangle, and it's got four different levels. And each of these levels is how people can help someone with a disability who's grieving. So it's kind of a continuum. So on the bottom level, you have education. And this is like what we talked about, right? We're providing death education before it happens. We're teaching death-related vocabulary. We're normalizing that death happens. So that's the bottom part. The second level is participation, and we talked about that too. How can we involve them in death rituals, in funerals, in wakes? You know, how can we help them, you know, be more involved in that? The third level is facilitation. And so this is where you're going to like focus a little bit more on expressions of grief and how people are feeling, how they're making sense of the loss. And then the last one is intervention. So that's where you're going to get maybe more direct counseling that's going to go through different things that impact your grief, you know, internal family systems, maybe cognitive behavioral therapy, something like that. So we've got these four levels, and the way that I see it is BCBAs can totally do those first two levels. We can do the education piece and we can do the participation piece. I think when we're starting those top other two levels with facilitation and intervention, that's where we probably want to collaborate with outside professionals, whether it's a licensed counselor, a mental health practitioner, sometimes even a spiritual leader, if that's something that's really important to the client and the family. But in my mind, we can do those two bottom levels and still be within our scope, yeah. But also knowing you do still need to go educate yourself about death. I'm not saying you have to go get like a, you know, the certification that I'm getting, but I would look at taking, you know, courses in some of this. You can go audit courses. I've got CEUs on it. There are even just some really great books that you can read that can kind of give you like a framework, because that's what we need. BCBAs need a framework of how death and grief are experienced. And then we can bring in our ABA knowledge.
Yes. Okay. This was like it's like a big topic, you know, and you say,
sorry, it was a lot. Sorry.
Yeah, it's a lot. No, it's good. You know, you say it so calmly. So it's not as, it's important. You know, I think even, we keep talking about it for children, for people with disabilities. But again, like, I think it's missing for a lot of people, for like myself included, typical adults of all different stages and ages. No one wants, you know, everyone's very busy. So I'm not, think it's, you don't want to think about like what's going to be in the future. That's going to be even more difficult. It's going to be harder, you know? So it's so important to bring up for ourselves and then of course for our kiddos. So is there anything else you want to bring up that you think is important that, or like stress to take away for our listeners?
Yeah, two things. So one thing, I would already start practicing using the words dead, death, and dying. There's a tendency for us to distance ourselves from death by using euphemisms like they passed away, we lost them, they went to sleep and didn't wake up. And that actually creates confusion for people with disabilities. An example that I like to give is I had a client and they were told that they, you know, mom said, hey, we lost grandpa last night. my little guy thought that, like, legit grandpa is lost. And so we saw an increase in elopement because the poor baby was trying to go find grandpa. Whoops. So we had to go back and, like, fix that. So I, you know, just get used to saying the words. And then I think also working on your own discomfort around death and, like, notice that, right? Well, why am I avoiding it? What are the parts that are scary? You know, what are my values when it comes to death and dying, and kind of thinking about those, like with my coursework, we had all these papers on, what do you want your death to look like? Which I know sounds morbid, right? But it's going to happen. And end of life is going to happen. But if we can start thinking about it and really noticing, like, what's happening in our body when we talk about it, I think that's a really good way to start. Address your own death avoidance, because then you're going to be able to address it with your clients.
That makes sense. Well, thank you, Trisha, for your valuable wisdom. We so appreciate it. And I am going, you shared a couple of links with me for people to reach out to you, some PDFs that I'll attach as links as well on the show notes. So thank you so much. And I am excited to see what this does for our listeners. And I really do want to hear feedback. So to everyone listening, I would love to hear feedback on how this either changed your perspective for yourself or for your clients. So thank you, Trisha.
Yeah, thank you.